A very good morning to you. It's Rebecca O'Sullivan here with you on Clare FM, and welcome to Hindsight, where we look back at some of the biggest and some of the best stories of the week. Coming up, Larry Brennan, father to the late Laura Brennan, calls for action instead of words from the HSE after widespread reports of HPV vaccinations being cancelled and staff are redeployed due to the pandemic. Clare sporting great John Callanan tells of his hurling and personal life in his book To Play To Live, and a call to action to save the curlew in Clare. But first on this morning's show, we turn to the story which spanned across the week, the vaccine rollout. Advice from NIAC saw a decision made to limit the use of the AstraZeneca vaccine to those aged between 60 and 69. Then Johnson & Johnson delayed their delivery to Europe due to similar concerns over blood clotting, leading to confusion in the public and chaos as the government were faced with another reconfiguration of the vaccine rollout. However, by Friday, things appeared to be back on track after Europe secured 545,000 Pfizer doses for this quarter, and Nefesh confirmed that the country was in a better place than we could have hoped for in our fight against the virus. On Friday's Morning Focus, Pat Flynn spoke to Fianna Fáil deputy Cathal Crowe about meeting vaccine targets, guarantees on a summer reopening, vaccine hesitancy around AstraZeneca, and Fianna Fáil's decline in the polls during the pandemic.
I think it's pretty certain that, we're now on the 16th of April. We have seen how the reopening of schools has gone over the last 3 weeks or so. It's gone well. We've all school children back now. That was a priority of government. And there's now a roadmap for getting all of these other sectors. And they're all shouting, and they're right to. They're hugely frustrated, pinning their collars up here. Some of them won't reopen as well. And that's going to be a huge damage to the economy. The economy has been very badly wounded, but yet there have been many supports put in place. The reality is, as we head to that target point of end of June, 82%, that is where you get to this herd immunity phase, a phase I've never liked, but nonetheless, it's one, I think, coined by Boris Johnson a year ago, and we're getting closer to that point. And with that come all of the benefits. I think there has to be a COVID bonus as well, as some people have said, for those who have been vaccinated. I was in my local supermarket yesterday, and without being ageist, there was a very clear age demographic all out doing their shopping because they've been vaccinated. They feel safer. They're circulating. And we need to see more of that. And we will see more of that.
But there has been, Cathal, you'll agree, a lot of confusion, a lot of issues have arisen over the... I know you touched on AstraZeneca, you touched on Johnson & Johnson. But the Taoiseach has said that anybody who refuses to take a vaccine should be put at the end of the list. Now, whatever about anti-vaxxers or people like that, people who are so afraid of taking the AstraZeneca vaccine and refuse to take it shouldn't be put at the end of the list, surely.
I just think the European Medicines Agency is concluding its report in a matter of days. So I know it's been reported.
No, specifically reported in relation to Taoiseach Leo Varadkar's comments on putting people at the end of the list. Surely if they're making a decision not to take the vaccine because they're scared, not because they're anti-vaxxers, they're being discriminated against. Where do you stand on that?
I don't necessarily believe someone... Look, if you're refusing a vaccine on the day, well, then someone else rightly should get that jab, because there's so many people who would run across the road and run across the country to get a vaccine any hour of the night, day or night. So I think we need to prioritise those who are willing to take it. However, yes, it's there's anti-vaxxers, and I don't agree with that myself. We've quite a few of them, but there's even some in politics. But yeah. what I would say is that those who have reasonable reservations, and the right to reasonable reservations and to be watching what's going on, I don't think necessarily they should go to the back of the queue, but they shouldn't expect that a vial of vaccine just sits on a shelf for them because they won't accept it today. It'll be there next week. It has to go to someone else. There's people at home. We still have some people in their 70s hearing this announcement that the 60 to 69 age bracket will be now vaccinated over the next 5 weeks. We still have some in their 70s waiting for that call up. So, we're slowly getting from phase to phase. And if someone's going to skip a phase, well, I don't think they should go to the back of the queue, but absolutely, get that vaccine to someone else and get it to them quickly.
Oh, absolutely agreed, but they shouldn't be put to the end of the queue. You rightly said there are people who will run across the road to get a vaccine. Those people who have been, and it is, of course, because everyone's being overcautious that a certain age group will not get the AstraZeneca vaccine. But if they choose to take it, if they want to take it, because they've looked at the data, they know well that the government and the medical professionals are erring on the side of caution here, being overly optimistic or overcautious rather. Do you think that people can or should be allowed to opt in to get the vaccine if they wish to do so, the AstraZeneca particularly?
I do, and this has been a debate happening over the last few days. So there's a lot of particularly younger people now who would be, it's been reported today that some of the under 60s will have to wait till June. Now June is going to be the biggest month of all for vaccinations, so some of them see a finish line, and it's great, it's still a little bit off, and they would like to be vaccinated a lot sooner. And I think there should be an option there. I'm one of those people. I'm 38, so I'd be one of those last. And a lot of people believe that politicians, we've jumped to the front of the queue. Absolutely not. I'll be at the back of the queue, and I'll rightly wait there till it's my turn. But if I was offered, as someone under 40 or someone in the younger age categories, if I was offered a chance to sign some waiver, to accept that there is a 1 in a million chance, and I want to stress that again,
yes,
there's a 1 in a million chance and there's a far, far higher chance of getting COVID and a far higher chance of complications of COVID, I would in an instant sign any waiver that was put in front of me. I think that debate needs to happen, but let's pause, I think, for a few days. We are, I think it's next Wednesday, we're going to have this momentous decision taken by the European Medicines Agency about Johnson & Johnson. If this gets the go-ahead, Pat, it's huge. This is the single jab vaccine. You'll only be in the West County or the Radisson once. You get the vaccine, and within a matter of days, you have all the antibodies you need with 99% efficacy to fight off COVID. And how magical would that be? It means that in the months ahead, we will have a reasonably normal return to life, and that we can hopefully over that next year period phase out masks, hand sanitizers, all the things that become a way of life. And there's a lot of young people. I'm even looking at my young kids. My youngest daughter, she's lived half her life in COVID. And, you know, for young people,
yes,
in particular, adults get their head around this. But for school-going kids and our younger population, this has dominated all of their talk.
It has, absolutely. Before I move on from the call, before I move on from the vaccine, just on the single jab, a single dose, the other side of that, the Pfizer, where you need the two, you need the two jabs, but you can extend the period between the two jabs as they've done in the UK. Is that possible here? Is that being considered here? And would that not allow for more people to get the first jab?
Yeah, it is. And I've been talking, I had a meeting on Tuesday with Dr. Ronan Glynn, who's now acting as Chief Medical Officer. So this is something certainly being looked at. And I don't want to say it's experimental, but they've certainly been looking at how this has worked in the UK. Boris Johnson's government's prioritisation from the get-go was, you know, jab the population, get them vaccinated, and we'll look at the second jab later. Now, I think that was a bit cavalier. In Ireland, we've been more conservative, more restrained. I think in the long run, we'll see the benefits of that. But they are going to look at a stretching out of that waiting period between jab one and jab two. And so far, there isn't any great scientific evidence out there to say that that's a bad thing in any way. And what it may allow is for more and more people, we might get ahead of that 82% target. And that was actually hinted at during the week. But the one thing, and I think politicians, probably one of the great failings of politics over the last 12 months, is at times it could be myself or another TD in the radio or a national radio minister over-promising, and that's something we certainly don't want to do, getting hopes up.
Okay.
There's a realistic one now. At the end of June is where we're aiming for.
But hopefully, and all that will go well, please, God. No other hiccups or hurdles in the meantime. On the opening of the vaccine portal, why now? Why did it take so long for this to be implemented?
I suppose the vaccine portal really lends itself to the new vaccine regime, where now it's going age by age and air code by air code. So there are elements that I don't like, and I'm on record on your show. Gavin interviewed me just last week about this. There are elements of the new vaccine regime I think could have been reviewed, such as priority and frontline workers. However, it's here, and it's here to remain for the next few months. It's very fast and efficient. So the portal wouldn't fully work until we move to this regime. What we're now seeing is this week, those age 69, in the 69 age bracket were registering yesterday. Huge uptake, about 25,000 nationally registered. And day by day now, it's moving through different phases of registration. And the expectation is that everyone all over 60 will be vaccinated in the next 5 weeks or so. So we're getting to our vulnerable population. You're most vulnerable depending on your age. Nursing homes are now pretty and relatively safe. So to our hospitals, ICU units have less and less people in them. And we're slowly getting down through those age categories. So it's working. And yet there had to be a pause button hit in the other day. But look, this is a rollout unprecedented. We've never seen the likes of it before. And I think we're slowly getting to the sweet point now where everything is starting to come into play. Vaccine rollout going good. A big decision to be taken next week, but ultimately getting to herd immunity.
Is there a concern that the delay in establishing the portal could now lead to delays in administering the vaccine? It seems to have come very, very late in the day. Are you still confident that the vaccine rollout will progress according to plan?
I am. My bigger concern about vaccine rollout, actually, Pat, would be the text message people are getting in Clare. And I was speaking with you last week about this. They're getting a very casual text message from an 086 number. Yes or no, will you accept a vaccine tomorrow in the Radisson? I know if I got that, ordinarily speaking, I would delete the message and believe it to be phony or hoax.
Well, we did discuss this, actually, Cathal, and fair play to you for raising it earlier this week. But the obvious point of that is people are so concerned. That could be an issue too, but people are so concerned about all the scam messages going around. At least if it's just one question, they're not asking for any other details because the person who's sending the text knows who you are. They're hoping that people will say, yeah, this seems genuine. They're not looking for information, not looking for any other information whatsoever. Yes. But I know you would encourage people to ensure that if they do get that text that they respond to it.
Absolutely. No, okay. It has been a feature, unfortunately, at the Radisson vaccination clinic where people haven't shown up because of it, and they need to tune into that text and just respond to it and go at their assigned time, day or night.
Okay, very finally, if we can then just, Micheál Martin was speaking on Virgin Media last night, suggested that opinion polls are putting Fianna Fáil to be just 11% approval rating, and he said that's wide of the mark. Why do you believe that is? I know that polls can never be entirely accurate and most people don't pay attention to them, but it's the only, I suppose, yardstick you have to measure popularity by. What do you think yourself in terms of that figure of 11%?
I think people are peeved with politicians. You know, and I mean that honestly, Pat, because ordinarily speaking, what politicians do is we mingle, we circulate in constituencies, something I look forward to doing next Monday when I get back to my clinics, and we deliver. We deliver in projects and we bring good news to people, by and large. That's what we aim to do. But for the last 12 months, much of what we've been doing in the Dáil is voting through health restrictions, people not being able to go 5 kilometres from home. I mean, God almighty, you know, it's all done in the interest of public health, but yet real draconian measures that none of us have enjoyed doing. And on that basis, there will be fall guys. I think Tony Holohan is the knight in shining armour, and rightly so. You know, he deserves a lot of credit, and our frontline health services, and probably politicians will be the fall guys. I suppose what I constantly look at is what's really going on here, because there's 3 parties in government. We're sharing the heavy lifting, and yet our counterparts in Fine Gael are on 32 or 33%, which is, you know, it's a nice place to be at. Look, I'm not... Right now, yes, we're always concerned about opinion polls. The main thing for now, though, is that we get vaccines rolled out, get the population safe, reopen the country. We may be thanked for this down the road. I certainly know my work as Clare's Fianna Fáil TD in the county has doubled and redoubled over the last number of months. We're working flat out, huge engagement with the public. I'm certainly not getting a brunt of dissatisfaction within the constituency, but people are really yearning for an end point to come to this, and I think we're coming quite close to that. We do watch opinion polls, despite what people say that we ignore them. We do watch them. And I look forward to Monday, okay, when I'm out doing my clinics again, reconnecting and doubling down in connections with the public. That's what I like most of all.
Mílic Fianna Fáil TD Cathal Crowe there on the tumultuous week that's just passed. Now, coming up after the break, we hear from the father of the late Laura Brennan and the family's calls for the HSE to prioritise the rollout of the HPV vaccine to teens. Welcome back to Hindsight here on Clare FM with myself, Rebecca O'Sullivan. Now, on Friday's Morning Focus, Pat Flynn was joined on the line by Larry Brennan, father to the late teammate Laura Brennan. Larry spoke of the family's frustration and lack of hope amid widespread reports of HPV vaccinations being cancelled by the HSE due to staff being redeployed during the pandemic. He firstly told Pat about when the problems with the rollout came to their attention.
Basically, we had got wind of it around the place. We knew it was in trouble last September when they went back to the schools, because the schools had problems letting the vaccination teams in. But we're shocked, and Laura would be shocked to think of what is happening at the moment. The impression we're getting is it's not been cancelled. It seems to be paused. That's the official party line out from the HSE, that it's been paused. But on one hand, our contacts have shown us that it's taken place around the country in some areas, like Dundalk, Athy, Charleville. We've got confirmation that the vaccine teams are out there for the second dose. But it's, it doesn't seem to be joined up thinking with regard to the HSE. They don't seem to know what's happening around the country. And they're, on one hand, they're sending out things like that. On the other hand, we have social media that is gone wild with regard to it at the moment. And but for the work of the likes of John Wall, who unfortunately seems to be answering these questions. And you know, John's illness, he's terminally ill. And he's out there and he's trying to answer questions. It should be answered from on high, and they're not being answered.
And do you know, Larry, whether any of those vaccinations you mentioned that are taking place in pockets around the country, if any are taking place in County Clare at all?
I don't know is the answer. The best, I wish to God people would ring in and see where we're at around the place, because the whole programme, the vaccination programme for HPV, okay, COVID-19, we all have COVID-19. You had the last 20 minutes with regard to COVID-19. But the show has to go on. 92 ladies per year die of this without the vaccine, so to do. And this can't, the results of this failure on behalf of somebody will come home to roost in 10 years' time. And they'll end up like we ended up in front of Laura as she was passing to the next world. And we don't want that. She didn't want that. She fought hard for this thing. She got the vaccine up to the acceptance rate up to 82%. The unusual thing about the current situation is the people want it. The students want it. The parents want it. That was Laura's fight to get them to take it. Now the problem seems to be the administration of it, which is a crazy system.
Yes, because Laura invested herself so much in this. And then the HSE, I suppose, took the baton and carried this on, but seem now to have dropped the baton, is that fair to say? Because while they had fought the fight alongside Laura for so long, it seems that it's almost forgotten now.
It's put on the shelf. The vaccines are on the shelf. There's enough there for 70,000 people in the country. The 70,000 students should be getting it. Like I say, it's just... like, we're really calling on the minister at this stage. We haven't heard from Stephen Donnelly about HPV. He's in the Dáil 12 months now. And not once have I heard him, or have we, that we're aware of, that he has come out and said, high up or low down, about the status of HPV, or is he in favour of it, is he against it? We don't know nothing. Micheál Martin comes out on the 30th of March and says, Laura Brennan's legacy must be honoured. We are calling on the people now. The people have honoured Laura's legacy by being willing to take it. But there are other people out there, I regret to say, that need to step up to the plate and honour Laura's legacy.
Yes, I know the family, Larry, accepts that there have been issues. You mentioned COVID-19. I know schools were closed. And I know that, and presumably as well, people who would normally be involved in that side, the HPV vaccination might have been redeployed. But still, it's not a huge population that they have to vaccinate. They're not vaccinating people with the COVID vaccine. It's the HPV. It's a smaller cohort that could, you believe, be vaccinated.
Pat, we had a meeting, I fully agree with you, we had a meeting or a Zoom meeting with the people in the HSC on the 16th of March, and we put forward what we thought, like Ellen Kelly, who's a passionate advocate of the thing and has declared as a passionate advocate. We all come out and we say we want this, we want that, we want the other, but there's no one. Have you seen anyone from the HSC, from the department, come out and say anything about the HPV and the status of the HPV?
It does seem to have gone very quiet on the issue, certainly.
No, but and I know we go back to COVID again, but even if they came out and said there's a plan in place, this is what we're trying to get across. We finally got the HSE, we're reliably informed. I have to be very careful with my wording.
Yes.
But we're reliably informed that there's a letter gone to the Minister's office with regard to our concerns. Now, we're waiting. It's over to the Minister now, and it's his department. There are people, his advisers are well aware of Laura Brennan. The Minister might not be aware of Laura Brennan, but his advisers around him are well aware of it, and we know that. So we want action now. We don't want it tomorrow. We don't want it the day after. We want a programme. The people, and we want someone to come out. And the social media, Laura was dreaded, the social media. She just dreaded them with regard to misinformation, etc., etc. Misinformation will blossom in the present climate with regard to HPV if someone in authority doesn't come out and give direction.
And sorry for cutting across you, Larry. There is, of course, a very small window here now because the schools are back, and the school won't be back for very long. They'll be back out again in a couple of weeks. How confident are you, Larry, that that the HSE will see the opportunity of availing of this window while to have students in the one place at one time and won't have after June, presumably? How confident are you that they might take see that and jump at the opportunity now?
I'm lacking confidence. I'll be straight. I'm lacking confidence until we see some form of direction from somewhere, because we are told on their own websites the first dose, the second dose should be taken within 6 to 12 months of the first dose. So they got the first dose last September. So the second dose should be administered before September. So it is. And it's on, like, remember where we've fallen to now, Pat. We were up at 82%. We are now down to 53%. That's diabolical to let a thing roll down there. And we all saw it coming, and we know that there was potential there to do something about it. But no, it's COVID, COVID, COVID. And this will come home to roost in 10 years' time, so it will.
It's so disappointing after all the hard work that has gone into it. And I know the family issued a statement coming up to Laura's second anniversary in relation to, you know, getting it back into the public mindset. Parents and teachers, Larry, do you think might have a part to play here? They have to fight the fight as well, haven't they?
Well, that's the beauty of the current thing. It's the people that are fighting it now. They're saying we want it. The whole thing has switched over from an awareness. Get the facts, get the vaccine. There is no problem getting the facts, getting the vaccine. They want it. But the problem rests with the department and with the HSE. How do they roll it out? And what plan is in place for rolling it out? And that's all we're asking for. That's all the people on social media are asking for, is direction.
Yes.
And a plan.
The information is there. The misinformation hopefully will all just melt into the ether. In relation to the pockets of schools that where vaccination programmes are ongoing, the HSE did give the statement, I won't read the whole lot because there's so much in it, but a very limited number of school teams have been able to restart clinics for school vaccinations, that the programme is ongoing. Uptake information is not available just yet. But they were saying as well that when you get the first jab, there's no specific time frame in which you have to get the second jab, which is some consolation. But still, the first jabs are the important one. Get started at very least anyway.
But, Pat, like, where are they going to start? I agree with you. Like, to see a thing drop to 53%, when does the light start flicking and say we have a problem? You know, there's something wrong somewhere. And I would argue with the department or the HSE over that, because they did say on their website it should be got between 6 and 12 months. Now the goalposts are slightly changing. Now maybe that's removed from the website. I don't know.
They're saying in the statement here, Larry, there is no maximum time limit for giving the second dose of the HPV vaccine. One never needs to restart the recommended HPV vaccine schedule. The HPV vaccine will be effective whenever the second dose is given. We'll see if the website changes or if that information changes. I presume they're not going to mislead us. That's the information that's currently available to us. But they do also say, in fairness, and I hope it's some consolation and some hope as well, maintaining high uptake of the HPV vaccine and honouring the legacy of Laura Brennan and her work with us is very important to everyone in the health service. Laura wanted to use her voice for good, and with her help, Ireland's HPV vaccination rates went from 50% to 80% in just a few short years. Of course, the problem now is, Larry, back down to 53%, as you said.
Yeah, but okay, I accept that. That want to order, honour Laura's legacy. Now's the time to do it. Let's see what they want to do. Words are cheap. saying things like that, and we have heard these words come before, honour Laura's legacy. The people of Ireland have honoured Laura's legacy by agreeing to take it. Let's see the department. What's their plan? And that's the simple thing we're asking. There's two things we're asking. One, what's their plan with regard to the rollout of it? An organised rollout that people aren't bringing them and getting conflicting information.
So,
and the second thing, Pat, we're asking, by the way, and it's another issue, so maybe some other day, we want a catch-up programme. We're trying to get a catch-up programme going for those who missed the vaccine. I know they'll tell you there's a catch-up programme for the current one because of COVID, but there are young people out there that have, unfortunately, they've reached the age of 16 and they can't get the vaccine. They have to pay €700. So these are the items that we have raised with the HSE, and with hopefully these items are gone on to the department with regard to looking for answers.
At least they got back to you, and at least there was some meeting, and I know you'll keep the, I know well you'll keep the pressure on, the family will keep the pressure on. So you want information, you want a plan, you want certainty, and you want the HSE to get off their backsides and sort this out.
Put in simple terms, you have it in one.
That was Larry Brennan, father to the late Laura Brennan, calling for clarity and action from the HSE on the HPV vaccine rollout. Coming up, Clare sporting legend John Callanan chats about his book, To Play to Live. Welcome back to the final part of this morning's Hindsight with myself, Rebecca O'Sullivan. Now, former Clare hurler John Callanan has put pen to paper and written an autobiography called To Play to Live, delving into his personal and sporting life. He chatted to Pat Flynn on Thursday's Morning Focus, firstly about where the idea to write the book came from.
I don't know if it's inspiration. A little bit of persuasion. Liam Hayes, the publisher and former Meath footballer, telephoned me and put the idea in my head. I was very reluctant. I didn't see that there was a story. So with a bit of persuasion, and I suppose being somewhat flattered, and I came around to the idea. It wasn't conceived by me anyway, Pat.
I know how shy you are, John, but going back, I suppose, the 90s is what all stands out for us, but it had to start somewhere. You would have been playing in the 70s and into the 80s as well, and I suppose you remember not only playing in the old field in Clare Castle, but also in Rosslevin when they were rebuilding Cusick Park. They were great days for Clare hurling too.
In Tulla? Yes. Absolutely, I mean, when we had to move from Cusick Park because of the renovations, the team was sort of coming together at the time, so it was coincidental. So then our arrival and the sort of the romantic appeal of rural Tulla, caught a lot of people's imagination, and a lot of our opponents for some reason didn't like playing there, and they probably put it down to the venue. But we weren't a bad team either, so we were winning a lot of our home matches, and it gave us sort of a fortress Tulla, which was fine by us. We didn't mind that. If the opposition didn't feel welcome there, that was all right by us.
Yeah. You don't remember playing out behind the Grove in Rosslevin?
Oh, I do, of course.
I thought my memory was shot.
I thought you were gone, but of course. We played County, I don't think, in Rosslevin. Oh, I played plenty of matches in Rosslevin, and tough matches in Rosslevin, yes.
Of course, you wore the black and white of the Magpies in Clare Castle and Clare as well. But when did your interest in hurling really begin? Were you born with a hurling in your hand, as they say?
Well, that's, I suppose, metaphor for the... I mean, there isn't... When I was growing up in Clare Castle, everybody hurled. It wasn't that you made a conscious decision. There was a hurling environment, a hurling atmosphere. And, you know, John Hanley was the principal of the school, and John was a dyed-in-the-wool hurling man, and a man ahead of his time in terms of coaching. He was involved in the garments and coaching. So he allowed us to hurl. It was a big part of the curriculum, I'll put it to you that way, Pat.
Yes.
So, there was no conscious decision, but it was the environment, and we all hurled.
Back in the 70s, John, it was presumably pretty much the same as now. There are certain teams who are hard to beat. There are certain teams you want to beat. Cork and Kilkenny probably would have been top of the list back there as well.
Yeah, Cork and Kilkenny and Limerick probably were in Munster was obviously Cork and Limerick. Tip weren't a big feature in the 70s. They went I love reminding the very people that they went 9 years without winning a Munster Championship match, not a mind a Munster Championship in, at that time. So yeah, Cork had a three-in-a-row team in the 1976, 1977, 1978. So they were the team, they were our nemesis as far as the Championship is concerned. But I mean, over a period of 4 or 5 years, we were very consistent, started from 74, I think, right through to 79. I think we qualified for at least the semi-final of the league and the final of the league on maybe three occasions and won two. So we were fairly consistent, but just couldn't get past Cork. I think our timing was a little bit off.
Some great players, and of course, Gerlach Nam went on later on to manage the Clare team. Was it as big a deal for you guys back in 77 and 78 to win the league for the first time since the 40s as it was for Clare to win the All-Ireland in 95 for the first time since 1914? Was that as big a deal for you guys then?
I don't know. Probably not. But it was massive. It was still huge for us. I mean, it was in 77. We'd been beaten in the final and a replay in 76, and we got back to the final in 77. So, you know, to make, as we would have seen for our group, and I suppose by extension for Clare, who hadn't won a league since 46, it was a huge deal of the national title, and it sort of indicated what we were doing or what we were trying to do in terms of making a team. And then we came back and won it again in 78, and it further endorsed what we thought we were doing right. Yeah, but to say, I mean, I suppose nothing will compare to the All-Ireland in 95 for all of us who were alive and there to see it.
You enjoyed it all, presumably. You're playing all the time between Clancastle and Flannans and inter-county level and all of that. Did you enjoy your time, really enjoy your time playing hurling?
Yeah, that isn't really a good question, because I suppose if I didn't, why was I doing it? But I mean,
we're looking back on it.
Yeah, we're looking back at it. Yeah, I suppose you don't necessarily enjoy the games. you enjoy the training and the camaraderie and the and striving to improve and obviously striving to win. But I found every match tough. You know, I found it's a bit like the golfers. You know the way they say it's always tough out there. You know, but I mean, I didn't find hurling easy, so I felt I had to work hard at it, and I found every game and every opponent very tough. But I mean, overall, I suppose the title kind of the book is To Play to Live. I was playing because that's how I lived. But I mean, we also had some great days. I mean, you know, the wins in Tulla, where we always celebrated them probably more so than they do nowadays. And so that social side of it was very enjoyable.
And what about when you finished playing? And do you remember what age you were when you stopped playing? You played for a long time. Yeah.
Well, I did. I played at county until 1987. I was 32 then, and I played then for a couple of more years. I played senior. I came back and played. I left Clarecastle to play with Partine, where I was living at the time, for a couple of years. And I came back and I played senior again in 1992. And then my cruciate ligament decided that was the end of it. So there wasn't any choice. Ultimately, there was no choice. I had to retire or stop playing anyway, whatever, about retiring.
Is there a suggestion, John, or is there a true story in that some county team came looking for you in terms of going up and coaching?
Yeah, in 1998, which was, you know, if anybody that's old enough to remember that year, as far as Clare hurling was concerned, I was approached by the county secretary of Offaly, and he, after the Babs Keating sheep in a heap remark when Offaly were beaten in the finals, they were looking for a manager, and they asked me to know would I be interested, and I was sort of flattered, and I had an arrangement made to meet with him and in Killaloe, and I'd spoken to Eamon Cregan, who I knew well, who had been the manager before Babs, and he had encouraged me, and I was, you know, I was flattered and I was interested, and I mean, an inter-county team would have been great, but on the day I was to meet him, I rang him and said, look, I would have been going to the meeting under false pretenses because I wouldn't have taken the job. There were phrases used like you'd be well looked after. I was very interested to know what that would be, whatever that means. But I said, my loyalty wouldn't allow me to manage or coach or indeed assist in any way any possible opposition to Clare. And I would have found the same thing. You know, I wouldn't have ever wanted to coach another club against Clare Castle. So
of course.
So I passed it over, and I mean I dodged the bullet when you see what happened afterwards with the Jimmy Cooney and the three matches between Clare and Offaly. I would not have liked to have been on the other dugout against Clare. No, something different might have happened that year, but yeah, no, that's a bullet I have no problem in allowing pass. But it was an interesting. An interesting offer at the time.
The book isn't all about hurling, John. It's very personal as well as about your life, obviously. How difficult was it to put a lot of those things, particularly losing your dad at such a young age? How difficult was it putting all that in writing?
Well, part of the deal, I suppose, with Liam Hayes was, there wasn't just going to be a kind of a list of matches that we won or a longer list of matches maybe that we lost. And he encouraged me to, I suppose, into the social side of it. And that sort of appealed to me, both, you know, not so much maybe the personal side of it, but certainly the social side of it, of growing up in Clare Castle and Flannans and all of that. But I mean, I had to, I had to deal with my father's early death. And it wasn't easy doing that, but it was, I still felt, for it to be sort of true and honest, it had to be looked at. And I was very young, and it didn't actually affect me sort of as emotionally as I thought, looking back, that it should have. But I think I was just too young. I just didn't really even understand at 9 years of age, you know, what death was. So Anthony Daly's father died, I think, when Anthony was 10. And we've had conversations about it. I think it had a far greater emotional impact on Anthony actually than my own father's death on me, which is a bit strange.
You're still very young at the time, of course, as well. And what else can, and not wanting to give too much away in the book, how personal does it get? What else do you talk about? Just give a flavour, shall we say?
Well, that was the other thing I sort of said to Liam Hayes, that I didn't really think I had anything that would kind of sell the book. You know, I had no big. I had no big story or any of my major faults. If I had them, I wasn't going to disclose them anyway. Yeah. So, look, you know, I was genuinely not sure if there was a story, because I think my life has been a fairly ordinary life. I was given a gift to play hurling, to be able to play hurling, and I played it. And that's, I suppose, about the only notoriety that I have. And I'm grateful to however I got that, whoever gave it to me, and whoever nurtured it. And I suppose the nurturing of it was probably important to speak up for the people who nurture young people and help them and assist them and put the wheels in motion for them and encourage them. And you know, there would have been, you know, Doyle Carey, John Henley, then into Flannan, and then Father Harry Bowen, you know, all of those people, from my own point of view. For what I got out of the game, I was happy to name them and mention those. And everybody, any player has those people, I suspect. You know.
Yes. Presumably, like everybody else, you want to get back out watching hurling, watching live hurling. What about the future of Clare hurling? We've had some great years down through the more recent decades. What about the future, John? Do you think?
Yeah. Clare hurling is always going to be tough. There I am again, I'm sounding like Tiger Woods. But, you know, we don't have it's not a huge county. You know, we don't have a huge panel of or pool of players. So I think it's going to be cyclical, you know. And I think, I suppose what we might have done in the 70s is that we sort of set maybe a plateau and then the team of the 90s obviously came and, you know, moved up from that plateau again. And then the team, you know, in the 2013 again did the same thing. It's going to be hard all the time to maintain that highest position. But we have to work at every level, at schools level, at club level, at county board level, at academy level, at colleges, to wring the last bit we can out of whatever talent we have. And anybody that sort of thinks that the quick solution is not living in the real world. And it just requires everybody, I think, to unify and get behind and make the game available to every young fella and every young girl. And there are more and more girls playing, which is great. That whole culture is good, I think, for the game. And I suppose we have to try and unite and get rid of division and just put what is in the best interest of Clare hurling to the foremost and work towards that.
Former Clare hurler John Callanan on his book To Play To Live. And to finish now this morning, we go to the Sleeve Octies. The sound of the curlew is unmistakable. However, we could be the last generation to hear its bird call, as the number of breeding pairs was reduced by at least 96% since the late 1980s here in Ireland. On Friday's Morning Focus, Pat Flynn spoke to Jack O'Donovan, curlew advisory officer for the Sleeve Octie team, about the conservation efforts that are underway.
Curlew, as you might know, is our largest wading bird and is a very iconic looking bird with that long down curved beak and its kind of mottled brownie feathers and long legs. And this bird has kind of particular needs. We'd often see it around our coasts in the wintertime, and wintering flocks can amass in actually quite large numbers. However, most of those birds are birds that are breeding in Scandinavia or in Scotland or other parts of Europe. So what's happening with our native curlew is that they go inland to breed, and they'll often breed on bogs or heath or kind of wet grassland. And that habitat is just being degraded very quickly in Ireland. So when the birds go back to make their nests, they're finding that the habitat that they require has been changed, or that there have been new threats brought in. So say by more forestry coming in, especially in the Sleeve Octies, we have about 50% forest cover now, where that would have been all upland bog once upon a time, which was perfect habitat for the curlew. And these curlews, the breeding population in Ireland, has actually declined by 97% since the late 1980s. So that's a huge loss, yes. Going from about 5,000 pairs down to about 140, 150.
Let me just play this for a second. It'll take a few seconds. Just stay with us there for a second, Jess. Let's just play this for a second. It never ceases to surprise me, the number of people who will go on social media some morning and say, I heard the curlew. This is very much part of Irish life, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, the curlew call is completely evocative with Irish life, and especially Irish country life. You know, a lot of people, like I said, associate with curlews by the sea. However, people I've met here now in the Sleeve Octies, you know, men in their 80s up in the bogs, who said, you know, when they were growing up, there was flocks of curlews in the area, which would have been true at the time, and that it's just such a remarkable sound. And they arrived back to the upland areas in March and April, and that's really the time that kind of marks the start of spring and the good weather and the cattle going back out into the fields. So it's a time when people would have been out on the land a lot. So it would have been a call that everybody would have been well aware of. And, you know, luckily, that clip you just played there was a clip I recorded in kind of the eastern half of the Sleeve Octies just last week. So curlew have returned to this area. However, we're down to only less than a handful of pairs breeding in these mountains. So we have a small team, two local lads, Jack Slattery and James Kane, Pierre Shogiboon from Connemara, and myself, who are working across the Sleeve Octies to find and protect the nests of these endangered birds, and also working in partnership with local farmers. And we actually have a brilliant new scheme called the Curlew Conservation Partnership, which is basically ourselves and landowners, be it people who might own a bit of bog or farmers, we work together to create a plan on how we can actually improve the land for breeding curlews. And the farmers and the landowners can actually get paid for all the work that they do to try to support these birds. And I think that's really key, because, you know, we hear a lot from government and different groups how we need action and we need this and we need that, but actually supporting the people who are on the ground, like the farmers, to, you know, farm in a more ecological way or in a way that encourages biodiversity is just brilliant. And finally, we have a partnership that's starting to work towards that.
So a lot of work is being done, but education obviously is quite important as well. Informing people, information, education, and making people, you know, make sure they're aware that these habitats are very important for the curlew to return here.
You're 100% right, and that's education across the board, from you know, young children to adults and people working on the land. Pierre Shogiboon is our curlew champion for the Sleeve Octies, and He's working on engagement around the area. Obviously, it's a bit more difficult now with the pandemic in place and, you know, events not going on as they should. So opportunities like this to discuss it on radio and newspapers and things like that are just brilliant to spread the word, because these upland habitats are often overlooked and they are so rich in life, even in Ireland's in our bogs. We have 10 to 11 species of carnivorous plants. So something you'd associate with a place like the Amazon or tropical rainforest. We actually find them in abundance in our bogs.
Two texts, Jack, before I let you go. Two texts coming in. A listener says they're often in Seafield and they counted 14 there recently, so alive and kicking in Seafield. On the other hand, there were flocks of curlews in the Craggard area of Bearfield. They were in a boggy area, but believe some cats did some damage in there, unfortunately, as well. So they are quite, they're right across the county, for, according to these two texts and the fact that you're up around Slievochty as well.
Wow, well, it's always great to hear reports. And what I'd say is, if anybody who is listening or any of your listeners do happen to hear or see curlews anywhere across Ireland, if they could email in their reports to an email address, is the nationalcurlewsurvey@gmail.com. So that's nationalcurlewsurvey@gmail.com. Or else they can also telephone in their report to the mobile number 083 830 1843.
Jack O'Donovan, Curlew Advisory Officer for the Slievochty team there on the conservation efforts to save the curlews. Now, unfortunately, that's all the time I have left for on this morning's show. Do join me back here again at the same time next week for another edition of Hindsight. And until then, stay safe and keep it tuned here to Clare FM.